Jack, by the way, will be giving this talk. He's a member of the Socialist Alternative Branch in Adelaide, and he's been involved in organising the anti-nuclear campaign there. So he'll talk for about 30 minutes or so, and then there'll be time for discussion. So hold, as all the other sessions, hold your thoughts, comments, questions and such till Jack has finished speaking. Thanks.
Cool. I've got a bit of a cold, so we'll see how my voice goes with this. I don't really want to spend much any time really explaining, like, you know, all the horrific predictions of what's going to happen to the world if fossil fuels keep getting burnt. That's been covered well by other comrades in this stream today. And also, if you've ended up in this room, I'm assuming you're well aware of the basics. You know, climate change is real. We're already seeing the effects of it, and it's only going to get worse. You know, the situation we're in, I think, is best expressed by Greta Thunberg when, you know, she told the world that, you know, I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. That's the, you know, situation we're in. What I'm here to talk about is one of the world's worst climate vandals, Australia. We are in a country that's just ruled by coal-crazed dinosaurs. No matter which side of Parliament you look at, you'll see fossil fuel crusaders who are willing to stand by corporations who want to tear the Galilee Basin from the earth, suffocate the Great Barrier Reef, and turn the Great Australian Bight into an oil field. So the question we should try and answer today is why. You know, why does Australia's ruling class so religiously devote itself to the fossil fuels that are destroying the planet? First, let's look at the scale of the problem. So the group Climate Transparency releases yearly reports comparing what action, or usually lack of action, G20 countries are taking to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Last year's report painted a pretty terrifying picture, suggesting that, like, none of these countries are meeting even their own measly climate targets. But Australia came off as, like, the worst criminal of all of them. So there's, like, this table that, like, compares countries' climate policy performance in 8 different areas. Only Australia ranks low in, like, almost every area. The average G20 country produces 8 tonnes of greenhouse gas emissions per capita. Australia produces more than double that average at 19.3 tonnes per capita. In 2017, coal, oil and gas combined made up 93% of Australia's energy mix, while renewables and other made up just 7%. And this isn't even to mention what I think is Australia's greatest crime of all, being the world's largest exporter of coal. None of this is about to get better by the look of things. You know, just consider the threat posed by the Adani coal mine. You know, so against the will of the vast majority of Australians, Adani is set to begin construction of a mine currently intended to reach a capacity of 27.5 million tonnes of coal per year. Although, keep in mind, they actually have, you know, formal approval to reach 60 million tonnes per year. And yet, Adani's only the beginning of the nightmare, really. You know, the mine will open the Galilee Basin. This is a giant, untapped reserve of thermal coal. And that will facilitate the development of other mega mines proposed by the likes of Clive Palmer and Gina Rinehart. If you imagine a fully exploited Galilee Basin, that would double Australia's coal exports to more than 600 million tonnes per year. If the entire coal seam were burnt, it would blow one-tenth of the world's carbon budget. You know, that's the amount we have left if we want to stop at 2 degrees Celsius global warming. And that's, you know, often how much scientists suggest we can afford to burn if we want to, you know, avoid the nightmare scenario of runaway warming. The madness in Australia goes beyond coal mining as well. You know, one of the big threats we face is the prospect of oil drilling in the Bight, you know, which the oil giant Equinor is hoping to commence soon. You know, apart from meaning more fossil fuels dug up and burnt, the drilling poses a direct risk of a disastrous oil spill. So in their own environmental plan, the company includes a model of a potential oil spill, which would devastate the coasts, not just of South Australia, but could stretch from WA to New South Wales and totally surround Tasmania. That's what Australia is prepared to risk to have a thriving and super profitable fossil fuel industry. So, yeah, that's the situation. Australia is pretty much the world's worst climate vandal, and our rulers would do worse if they could. You know, Australian governments aren't just passive supporters of the fossil fuel industry. They're notorious for supporting mining and energy companies with giant subsidies. There's the group Market Forces. They estimate that tax-based fossil fuel subsidies cost about $12 billion a year federally to support both the production and use of fossil fuels. On top of this, there's various other, you know, variety of other kind of direct contributions and handouts made by federal and state governments to fossil fuel business. But why? You know, the obvious first thing to point out is pretty simple. It's just the immense wealth that's currently generated by just one commodity, coal. You know, capitalism, after all, is a system where profit-making tends to overrule all other considerations. So in 2015, the energy industry generated about $96.6 billion. The vast bulk of that came from exports, which is $67 billion, and coal was by far the biggest export earner, at $37.9 billion. Indeed, in 2016 to 17, coal consisted of over 75% of energy exports. There is a kind of left-wing common sense, I think, about how Australia's coal barons come to dominate politics. The common understanding is that you know, the mining industry, fueled by these super profits, exercises a direct, intimate control over politicians and parties through their lobbying efforts and donations. The idea is that money rules everything, and that big coal kind of holds puppet strings over politicians. And there's certainly some truth to this. You know, mining companies have used donations to try and intervene into politics. So in 2010 to 11, that was the biggest year for mining industry donations to parties in the past decade. There were $3.8 million in donations, and the vast majority, $3.5 million, went to the Liberals. This was their reaction to Kevin Rudd proposing a tax on mining super profits in 2010. The Minerals Council of Australia also spent almost $16 million on a public propaganda campaign against the tax. The Labor Party pretty easily caved to this pressure. They replaced Rudd with Julia Gillard, who then got rid of the tax and sent a message that Labor would act loyally to mining profiteers. The Minerals Council, that's like the, you know, association of significant mining companies, they don't tend to dupe the wider public very much with their TV advertisements. You know, for example, when the Paris Agreement was getting negotiated, they launched an ad campaign called Coal, It's an Amazing Thing. And that was widely mocked for, you know, panning across this horrible, dark landscape of coal, while a soothing voice tells us, it's amazing what this little rock can do. But the MCA certainly boasts its influence over politicians, if not public opinion. So the council explained last year how you know, the MCA makes political contributions because they provide additional opportunities for the MCA to meet with members of Parliament. The MCA uses these opportunities to update members of Parliament about conditions in the Australian minerals industry and the policy priorities of the MCA. Alongside these lobbying efforts, the other really noticeable thing is a revolving door between careers in official politics and in corporate Australia. You know, so many political advisers who today work for senior politicians, yesterday worked for the mining industry. Likewise, politicians themselves have found jobs in the industry after leaving politics. So you can look at the former Resources Minister, Ian McFarlane, who took up a position at the Queensland Resources Council. There's, you know, Sophie Mirabella, who was hired by Gina Rinehart as a lobbyist. In fact, Scott Morrison's Chief of Staff, John Kunkel, is the former Deputy Chief Executive of the Minerals Industry and also worked at Rio Tinto. There's the current Environment Minister, Melissa Price. You know, she was once a lawyer for the mining company, Crosslands Resources. That's the Environment Minister. You know, I could go on listing these sorts of people. The essayist Anna Crean has described the situation like this. Australia has a political system captured by the fossil fuel industry. It is a political Stockholm syndrome, built on donations, royalties, taxes and threats. Parliament has become a transit lounge for politicians and their staffers on the way to fossil fuel companies and their lobby groups. She proposes solutions such as banning political donations or requiring all politicians to wear the logos of their sponsors on their jackets, like Grand Prix drivers do. I love that idea, but I would argue that the intimacy between the Australian state and the fossil fuel industry has deeper roots than just these kind of instances of cronyism. Careerism and dark money can only explain so much. So as Melbourne Uni's professor Robin Eckersley has commented, you know, there's this groupthink that what's good for the minerals industry is good for Australia, and what's good for Australia is good for the minerals industry. And this attitude is true of all noteworthy politicians from the governing parties, whether or not you can find some direct dirty association between the politician and the mining industry. They all act to prop up and subsidise the coal industry with this like special treatment afforded to barely any other corporations, no matter how much other corporations might donate to the parties. So take Julia Gillard, for example. She's the only ever Prime Minister from Labor's so-called left faction. Today, she doesn't rake in cash doing dirty deeds for coal bosses. Instead, she wanders around Adelaide Uni, occasionally giving lame surprise appearances in first-year humanities lectures. But still, in power, Prime Minister Gillard jumped to defend coal from environmentalist groups. So in words that could have been spoken by Donald Trump, you know, she declared that the coal industry has a great future in this country. We're seeing that future being built now. Yeah, indeed, like Labor has kept trying to build this coal-fired future through their support for Adani. In Queensland, Palaszczuk's Labor government, after an election campaign where they promised to save the reef, they got in, then crusaded for the mine and poured public funds into new infrastructure supporting the coal industry. So they moved to expand the Abbott Point coal terminal. They declared Adani's mine a critical infrastructure project, which is supposed to exempt it from various planning controls and legal obligations. I think most outrageously, they granted Adani an unlimited 60-year licence to draw water for the mine from the nearby Betts Creek formation. This is despite estimates that in 10 years' time, the mine could be using 26 million litres of water a day, and thus wrecking water flows into the Great Artesian Basin. Even the Labor-controlled Townsville City Council is spending like $18.5 million on an airstrip for the mine out of public money. And also, you know, we shouldn't expect any environmental conscience from any incoming federal Labor government. So Bill Shorten, last November, when trying to justify his non-opposition to Adani, stated that, I believe that our policies on renewable energy will actually reduce our emissions. But the actual decision about Adani is not going to affect Australian emissions. You know, so he speaks as though it matters to the atmosphere where the coal gets burnt. Given this political consensus in support of coal, I reckon a political system hijacked by the money of just a handful of capitalists is not the full picture. You know, Australian politicians are not just puppets. They actively fight for coal. They believe in it. So I'm going to talk about why this is. And to start answering this, I think we need to understand that coal has a deep entrenchment as one of the preferred sources of energy in the capitalist mode of production. The triumph of coal as the dominant energy source goes back to the Industrial Revolution in England. Once upon a time, water power was the preferred energy source of enterprise. So in early 19th century Britain, water flow had the advantage of being free, as well as abundant in Scotland and northwest England, where the cotton industry was based. But as industrialisation developed, the advantages of steam increasingly emerged. So coal, unlike water flow, is mobile. Water-powered mills and factories, of course, had to be built next to water sources. But with coal, the capitalists could transport the power source to wherever prime labour forces were centred. Larger concentrations of capital required large, disciplined workforces that simply didn't exist in the rural, watery areas. And so the owners of water-powered mills would have to often invest in building these sorts of colonies of labourers, you know, which could be a significant outlay. It could also result in heightened industrial strife. But for the capitalists who instead used rapidly expanding towns and cities as a labour pool, you know, paying for coal was increasingly a worthwhile investment to them. The Factory Acts in the 1830s as well constituted something of a turning point. So they limited working hours, which disproportionately screwed over water-powered factories. Previously, periods of low water supply would be made up for by imposing longer hours on workers to offset lost production. But yeah, most importantly, you know, coal just unfettered the bourgeoisie geographically. It allowed the expansion of the railways and freed capitalism, as Marx described it, to settle everywhere, nestle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. And the roots of global warming lie in this triumph of coal in the 1800s. You know, economic and military competition meant that fossil fuel methods were rapidly mimicked by the advancing capitalist economies around the globe. They just had no choice if they were going to keep up. So by the end of the 19th century, you know, the industry and railroads of the United States of America were burning more coal than the British. Before moving back to Australia, I think we have to appreciate that on a world scale, the whole infrastructure of capitalism has been built on fossil fuel. Enormous historic investments would need to be written off if we were to transition to renewables. And such a large-scale write-off of capital has no precedent. You know, capitalism demands that costs are retrieved. So even once the cost of, say, a power plant has been recovered, it's still better to keep it in operation for as long as possible. Decommissioning the structure and building a new one would just be to start all over again and lose any market advantage. So capital has this vested interest in the endurance of the fossil fuel landscape. The alternative is a project measured in trillions of dollars to bring the world to 100% renewables. And from their perspective, this is an exercise in wasted wealth. Marx once said that the tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And this rings true, I think, with climate catastrophe today. The past seems to dominate and trap the present. And this is a notion to keep in mind when you consider Australia's history as well. So from the inception of industrial capitalism on this continent, coal emerged as really central to the structure of the economy. So the New South Wales industry was established by the state, largely, in a fairly coordinated, fairly monopolistic fashion. In 1830, you know, the significant Newcastle mines were handed to the Australian Agricultural Company, which, along with a handful of others, just dominated the industry for a century. The company built Australia's first major railroads in the 1830s, the purpose of which was to transport coal, and they, you know, they did so by taking up the government's generous offer of super cheap convict labour. The historian Robin Golan has explained how Australian capitalism grew up based on coal. He said, "The coal industry grew up as part of the general growth of the economy. The early development of large capital cities, the extension of the railways and their conversion to coal burning, the establishment of coal gas as the normal means of public and private lighting in a society whose population nearly trebled between 1860 and 1900. These are the reasons for the expansion of demand. Heavy investment from both internal sources and from Britain was attracted by the high rates of profit, with the result that supply tended to outrun the Australian demand. And so about one third of all coal produced in New South Wales between 1860 and 1914 was exported." Another aspect of the history is that mining employers associations emerged in close association and collaboration with other employers groups, particularly in shipping. These associations formed a real vanguard of employers' resistance to young trade unionism in the late 19th century. And so coal employers were applauded by the whole bourgeoisie and the state for their anti-union campaigns and lockouts in that period. The coal has been so central to Australia for about 200 years is significant. You know, again, you know, the past weighs like a nightmare on the present. In capitalism, political power grows from economic clout. The coal barons, along with capitalists in associated industries, have been central to the development of Australian capitalism from the beginning. And so the influence of the coal industry didn't come from outside Parliament. It was right there in the beginning. Looking at the board directors of major mining companies in history, you'll usually find a lot of direct links with politics, like today. And just a few examples might give you the gist. There's George McCulloch. He was a key figure in the early days of BHP. He was the brother of the Victorian Premier, James McCulloch. There's a prominent South Australian leader, John Darling Jr. He was also BHP's chairman in the early 20th century. And there's even the case of the early Labor politicians. So among the first set of Labor candidates elected to the New South Wales Parliament in 1891 was Henry Newman. He wasn't some working class guy. He owned several mines himself. I'm trying to convey that the situation we have today is not an aberration. We've always seen this the economic significance of coal has always ensured the loyalty of the parliamentary system. So today, the mining of coal continues to benefit not just the mining bosses, but the state and vast sections of Australian capitalists. So, there's the tens of billions in export earnings. They provide the state with considerable royalties and tax revenues, underpinning Australia's record-breaking period of economic growth. Coal mining has also provided a steady flow of large profits for associated industries such as transport and logistics, engineering, construction, and legal and business services. Further, there's the abundant, cheap and easy supply of electricity that coal production tends to provide for the rest of industry. So we have this arrangement in Australia where, businesses pay lower power bills at lower rates than households do. Boosting profits across the entire economy like this is especially important in the context of the emergence of new global rivals like China. And this brings us to perhaps the most important consideration as to why Australia's politicians and state bureaucrats identify the coal industry with the national interest. Modern capitalism is not just competition between firms, but imperialist competition between nation states, each of which is looking to advance its own sphere of influence for its capitalist class to operate in. So while not a superpower, Australia is an imperialist power that needs to compete and play the game to ensure its place in the pecking order. And this means exploiting whatever resources are at its disposal. And Australia having the planet's fourth largest coal reserves is a massive advantage that our rulers are just not willing to abandon. Being a giant coal exporter can give Australia some leverage, over the countries it supplies in the cutthroat world of global trade. And so, again, I think irrespective of the corrupt influence and revolving doors in politics, it's imperialism that truly gives Australia its incentive to exploit these massive reserves. It's worth saying that, every other country is subject to these same dynamics of competition. So countries like Indonesia, India and China that have been driving global demand for coal, they've all been under pressure to develop as quickly as possible to avoid being left behind by their rivals. That's why I think we can't solve climate change in this competitive system. We should not hope for a capitalist transition to renewables in Australia. As we've established, coal is a powerful commodity because it's so deeply embedded, invested in, and abundantly available. They're not just going to give this up and dismantle the most important and powerful companies in the country. Some have argued that with falling costs in renewable power and investment in renewables gradually increasing, surely capitalism is going to transition. I think this is a pretty disastrous attitude. You can take one look at how the scales are still tilted globally. World energy production in 2016 consisted of 65.3% fossil fuels, 10.4% nuclear, 16.3% hydro, and 8% other renewables. Even in the hypothetical that investment in renewables continues to grow at its current rate, progress toward a new energy system will move at a snail's pace and leave us really in environmental catastrophe. And the notion that we're entering a transition in Australia is even more absurd. you know, where fossil fuels continue to make up about 90% of the energy mix. So any way you look at it, I think the system is addicted to fossil fuels, and coal remains very important to Australia. For at least a decade, our rulers have stood for, you know, opening the Galilee Basin for business and have thrown their lot in behind the Adani coal mine. Some economists have, like, projected that this doesn't stack up economically. And you could see some truth to this. You know, there's not, it's not like coal prices are what they were at the peak of the mining boom. Perhaps not as many coal-fired power stations are being built in the world as were projected in 2010. And most concerningly right now for Australia, there's this uncertainty immediately with China starting to limit some coal imports for its own reasons. But regardless, we shouldn't rely on the business case. You know, for one, things can change. You know, there's these newly announced plans, for example, to build this huge new coal-fired plant in the Hunter Valley. But more generally, I think the global decline in coal demand is usually overstated. So yes, some countries are closing fossil fuel power plants and seeing a relative increase in clean energy usage. But other countries are upping the contribution of coal to their power sectors. So I was reading a recent report from the International Energy Agency, and they concluded that global demand for coal remains, all things considered, strong and stable. After 2 years of decline, 2017 saw coal demand grow by 1% and coal power generation grow by 3%. And the agency expects that these trends are going to continue. You know, it can be predicted that Indian and Chinese demand for coal will grow at a slower rate in coming years, but demand is forecast to shoot upwards in countries like Pakistan, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam and the Philippines. Likewise in Europe, you know, Sweden, France and Denmark may accelerate renewable usage, but it's a different story in Eastern Europe, you know, with new coal-fired power plants being constructed in Poland, Greece and the Balkan states. And so, you know, when you read the recent edition of Australian Mining, which I don't recommend you do, you find triumphant reports of coal exports to Asia last year and projected earnings for the future. They're actually quite happy at the moment. Predictions aside, the central thing from Australia's strategic perspective is that there's a massive coal in the ground. Coal has always been an advantage for the nation, and they want to develop the infrastructure for future potential coal mines, you know, for future advantage. They probably just lay awake dreaming of a new era of Australian dominance as the world's supplier of coal. The Adani Group happens to be, you know, the corporation most willing to take a risk, so to speak, and to try and open a mine in the so far undeveloped area, to develop, you know, extensive railway for getting coal from pit to coast. And they've poured billions into the project already. They're not going to step down based on uncertain projections. Indeed, you know, Adani have been building, recently planning and building new coal-fired power plants in India, trying to give confidence to the Carmichael project in Queensland. For Australia's political establishment, the defeat of the project would mean a blow to prospects of coal expansion and just leave a mass of potential wealth and power trapped in the ground. I think the only thing stopping, like, Queensland Labor and the federal government from helping to finance the project is the prospect of public backlash. You know, Adani has become a hated symbol of corporate destruction of the environment. And hopefully as, you know, students and workers, you know, continue to disobey politicians and protest for climate justice, Adani should keep becoming political poison. It's up to our side to fight back against the Adani coal mine, against every new proposed coal mine. But in this fight, we need a certain political clarity. The forces of the market will not save us. The Labor Party will not save us. We have class enemies for whom Australia's coal addiction makes perfect sense. We'll need to drag them kicking and screaming to make any progress, and ultimately overthrow their system if we're going to leave coal in the ground and transition to 100% renewables before it's too late.